United States of America versus Carol E. Coulson, appellant, whose actions will be punished with martial for the appellate.
May it please the court, counsel, Tony Axum on behalf of appellant Carol Tolson, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the district court erred by concluding that no conflict of interest existed and that Ms. Tolson's attorney was otherwise effective. Moreover, the district court erred in concluding that Ms. Tolson's allegations did not warrant a hearing regarding the asserted conflict of interest and ineffective claims against her lawyer. This is a case where the motion before the district court plainly alleged that a third party, a man named Freddie Jacobs, was paying Ms. Tolson's attorney to represent her.
Was there any more than an allegation? I think, now you stated the court found there was no conflict. I'm not sure there really was a finding that there was no conflict, but that there was no conflict that affected the representation. But was there anything here other than an allegation that it was, in fact, what was his name, Jacobs, who paid the paid Nichols' fee?
There was no more than an allegation.
Is that enough by itself to get a prisoner brought back for hearing or to entitle him to a hearing, just a bare allegation?
Your Honor, what I would say is that an allegation that a third party who has interests adverse to the defendant is paying
focus
that
defendant's. Focus on the word allegation. Is an allegation alone sufficient, or does there have to be some sort of showing?
Well, that's precisely my point, Your Honor. There does have to be a showing, but an allegation is sufficient to merit a hearing. And in this case, not even a hearing.
Didn't the government present some paper evidence, at least, that the attorney either did not know it was Nichols or that it was not clear that it was Nichols? I mean, Jacobs, excuse me, well, that Nichols was not clear that it was Jacobs?
Well, the government similarly presented an allegation that
the government presented something that said that Nichols said the fee came from a family member of Ms. Tolson, did they not? I'm not sure now what that was. They referred to the testimony of Nichols, but what?
Your Honor, the government's brief or the government's motion before the district court, there was no testimony. There was never testimony on the motion to withdraw the guilty plea.
Were there any affidavits from either side?
There were no affidavits from the defense, and there were no affidavits from the government. All of the allegations were included in the text of the motions that were filed, and I'll say to the court that is a common practice. I recognize mm-hmm.
I'm not fussing at you, counsel. I'm just trying to make sure I understand the record in front of us here.
Yes. So it's an allegation that the government raised, but it's an allegation that was contrary to the allegations that Ms. Tolson raised in her motion. So it places us right back in the position of needing a hearing to require to resolve the conflicting allegations. In this case, the court did not allow a hearing. Ms. Tolson also alleged in her motion to withdraw her guilty plea that her attorney had failed to discuss with her defenses in this case. And although the conflict of interest claims fall under Kyler v. Sullivan, her attorney's failures to discuss defenses go straight to the heart of his effectiveness under Strickland. And this court has held in United States v. Taylor specifically that where an attorney has failed to discuss potential viable defenses with a defendant, that defendant is really entitled to a hearing, and if there is if the defendant's allegations are plausible, that defendant is entitled to have her motion to withdraw her guilty plea granted. The district The district court, in deciding that there was no conflict of interest and that Ms. Tolson's lawyer was otherwise effective, relied on a finding that was clearly erroneous. And it made reference to it several times, but the district court, for some reason, believed that the plea agreement required Ms. Tolson to cooperate against Freddie Jacobs.
And it required her to cooperate, right?
It required her to cooperate, but there was
if, in fact, Freddie was the perpetrator, then it required her to cooperate against him, right?
That is not clear.
Why isn't it? If he were the perpetrator and she knew it and she were sworn to cooperate, then it would seem a priori that, or a fortiori, in this case, anyway, it would seem to follow that she would have to cooperate against him.
Your Honor, that is certainly.
There's never been a plea agreement that said you could selectively cooperate.
That's correct.
If there's somebody out there who's guilty, who is a perpetrator, and you are entering a plea agreement to cooperate, then it would seem necessarily you're entering a plea agreement to cooperate against that person, wouldn't it?
I say that not necessarily. Any cooperation agreement there is dependent upon what the defendant knows, what the defendant mm-hmm. knows, and what the defendant is capable of mm-hmm. doing. So if the defendant knows of a perpetrator but is not capable of getting close to that perpetrator, that cooperation agreement may not necessarily require that defendant to get close to that.
But in the first instance, it does require that she reveal whatever she knows about the perpetration of the crime, doesn't it?
That is usually the process. Mm. And the cooperation plea
agreement. Usually meaning always, right?
it is. What I'll say is I can't imagine a situation where the government does not want to know. Yes, it should always happen. It does not always happen. In this case,
what I'm coming to is I'm not sure how you can say the judge was clearly erroneous in saying that she agreed to cooperate against Jacobs if she agreed to fully cooperate, and you are correct that Jacobs was a perpetrator, then doesn't it follow that she had agreed just to what the judge said in his order?
Your Honor,
memorandum.
That is a correct inference.
Okay.
I will agree that that's a correct inference. The problem is that it's an inference and that there are equally plausible opposite inferences. For example, it is equally plausible that she was required to cooperate against anyone who she had debriefed about, mm-hmm. but there is no record evidence about. We only know of Freddie Jacobs' name because within the plea agreement he is mentioned. But if he was, the government alleges that Mr. Nichols claims that Mr. Jacobs was not a target, and the government says that it did not know who the targets were. And I suppose that's why I keep stumbling over what should happen. Ordinarily, you would think, yes, that's logical, but it then becomes illogical that Mr. Nichols is saying that Mr. Jacobs is not a target, and the government is saying that it doesn't know who the targets are. So there was obviously something that happened in this case that was inconsistent with what should happen. And without a hearing, there's simply no way to resolve those inconsistencies. I see that I'm down to within my rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Axman.
Good morning. May it please the court. Gregory Marshall on behalf of the United States. With me is Assistant United States Attorney John Dominguez, who handled the plea and litigated the motion below, and Assistant United States Attorney Elizabeth Trozman, the Deputy Chief of our Appellate Division. Your Honors, Judge Lambert certainly acted well within his discretion here in summarily denying Ms. Tolson's motion. I just want to follow up with regard to some questions that Judge Sentell asked. Ms. Tolson did not submit any type of affidavit, declaration, or any type of sworn evidence. Not only that, but she did not submit any specific proffer, unsworn proffer of evidence here. What she asserted was nothing more than a bare allegation, a naked assertion, and that is that Mr. Jacobs had paid for Mr. Nichols's representation of Ms. Tolson. In fact, that allegation wasn't even put forth in appellant's initial motion below. Mr. Jacobs is never mentioned in that pleading. His name first surfaces only in appellant's reply pleading. Now, the government put forth in its motion below information which is materially different from the defense's information, and that is we made a specific, albeit unsworn, we made a specific proffer of evidence with regard to what Mr. Nichols would say happened, and that is that he was not paid by Mr. Jacobs. He was paid by a family member of Ms. Tolson. He also went on and he stated that he did not have any conflicts during his representation of Ms. Tolson. He also went on and stated that he advised her of her rights and he advised her of her legal alternatives.
If there had been an affidavit from Ms. Tolson to the effect that the fee was paid by Jacobs, would that have warranted a hearing then?
I think it depends on, Your Honor, the contents of that affidavit. I think if the judge, if the affidavit identifies the source of that information, I think if the judge can discern that the source of that information would be able to be brought into.
Well, she says, I sat there and watched him pay. Let's just say she has an affidavit that sets forth in concrete terms that Jacobs paid the fee. Is that going to be enough to warrant a hearing?
I believe so. I think typically that would warrant a hearing, yes, Your Honor.
So what we're lacking here is not a viable theory, but sufficient evidence to support that theory, in your view?
Correct. There's no evidence to support the theory, and in fact, not even good unsworn allegations with regard to it. So given that there were no sworn evidence submitted to Judge Lambert, given that there were no specific unsworn proffers of evidence with regard to the alleged conflict, he certainly acted well within his rights to summarily deny the motion. I would just also like to point out that the government's proffer of evidence was entirely consistent with a representation that Mr. Boss, Ms. Tolson's first attorney, made to Magistrate Judge Kaye on May 15th of 2003. And what Mr. Boss told the court was that he had conferred with the family of Ms. Tolson, and it was his understanding that Mr. Nichols would be making his appearance because the family had retained him in that matter, the family of Ms. Tolson. If there are no further questions from the panel, the government would rely on its submission to the court and the authorities cited therein, and we would respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Axelman.
What I would like to say about the affidavits is that we recognize that that affidavits are favored by this circuit in motions to withdraw guilty pleas, certainly when claims of ineffectiveness are made concerning events that have taken place outside the record. But the government does not cite any authority for what it's asking the court to do now, to find that the failure to submit an affidavit or to include the allegations in an affidavit in and of itself is a basis to deny a hearing.
Was there an unsworn proffer of evidence to the effect of Jacobs paying the fee, or just an allegation? It's not the same thing.
I recognize that, and there was not an unsworn proffer of evidence, but At the same time, these were not just bare allegations or naked assertions without specifics. There were many specifics. There were many specifics about what Ms. Tolson had told law enforcement, AUSAs, her attorney prior to entering this plea. There were specifics about that were placed before the court that had not been before the court before about the ownership of the premises, who had dominion and control over the rear bedroom, where in the premises the drugs and gun that Ms. Tolson pled to were located. These were not simply these were not bare allegations. They were very specific.
What was the untoward effect on the representation that was alleged or claimed?
The prejudice to Ms. Tolson.
Okay, prejudice. What was the prejudice?
Well, firstly, she didn't. She wasn't in a position to evaluate her options. Her attorney never discussed her defenses with her.
Well, counsel, that you say that, but that's a nice generality. But unless she had an honest defense, he's not supposed to discuss perjured testimony, for example, with her. So we're wanting a specific answer now.
Your Honor, I believe that she did have defenses. She certainly had the defense of mere presence and no knowledge of the drugs and the gun in the rear bedroom. She had the defense of testifying herself about Freddie Jacobs and him being in possession of them. The problem is that by not discussing those things with her, her attorney led her to believe that because she was present, she was guilty of the items that the police recovered in the apartment, a small apartment, and she had no choice but to plead guilty. Instead of expanding her options, he foreclosed them. That was certainly prejudicial to her, but he foreclosed them under a plea agreement that required a mandatory 15 years in prison. No rational person would accept this plea agreement with the possibility, the only possible benefit under the plea agreement was
if she cooperated and she got a letter.
Was to cooperate.
If she cooperated and got a letter, then.
And at that point, any competent attorney would have to assess the viability of cooperation.
Right.
In this case, cooperation was not realistic. It certainly wasn't realistic when the primary person, the only person against whom we know she can cooperate, is paying her attorney. It certainly wasn't realistic when you later learn that she is a drug addict and tests positive from the day that she's released from jail. Everything was consistent with failure here. Ms. Tolson's attorney did not engage her in a way that any reasonably competent attorney would engage her. Simply to summarize, Your Honor, there were allegations before the district court that Mr. Jacobs was a target, that he paid Ms. Tolson's legal bills, and that he failed to discuss her defenses with her. And because these allegations, if true, establish a conflict of interest or ineffectiveness by our attorney, the district court should have granted her motion to withdraw her guilty plea. At a minimum, these allegations raise the possibility of a conflict of interest, which under Wood v. Georgia, the district court was required to inquire further. It engaged no further inquiry. It did not call the parties back at all. It issued a memorandum order denying the motion to withdraw the guilty plea, as well as a hearing thereon.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Axum. Case is submitted.